Well, good evening. As Jeff mentioned, our topic this evening is Jephthah. Before we get into looking at his life, what I want to do is just start off with a little background of where exactly Jephthah fits in to the time period of the Judges and of the Old Testament. So we have here just a brief timeline of the Old Testament from the Exodus to the beginning of Solomon's reign. And the number of years that fit into the sequence, as well as the chapter and verses of where you actually get the length of times that are noted here. So we have 40 years in the wilderness in the time period for Moses during the Exodus. And then you have this time period of the Judges, which is sort of a long period of time. We aren't told exactly how long it lasted. And we have 40 years that Saul reigned for, and then 40 years that David reigned for. And we're told in 1 Kings chapter 6 and verse 1 that the time period from the Exodus until the beginning of Solomon's fourth year, so 3 years into Solomon's reign, was a total of 480 years. So all of this time period covers a total of 480 years. If we zoom in on the period of the Judges, we have a list of all the various judges and how long they judged for, as well as the years that they served other nations. And you can see Jephthah highlighted down here in yellow. He's toward the end of the time period of the judges. He's one of the last few judges of Israel. In our reading in Judges chapter 11, we're given another little piece of information which really helps us nail down exactly when Jephthah was judging Israel. And that's Judges chapter 11. And at verse 26, Jephthah was talking to the Ammonites, and he said, "While Israel dwelt in Heshbon and her towns and in Aroer and her towns and all the cities that be along by the coast of Arnon 300 years, why therefore did ye not recover them within that time?" And so it gives you a reference that he's 300 years from when Israel came into the promised land and when they conquered this region. And so if you slot that in there and you put in the 300 years, you can see the time period of Judges was then about 357 years, and Jephthah was judging Israel about 57 years before the reign of King Saul. So that's a little background. That's where Jephthah fits into the timeline of the Judges. I want to just look briefly at the geography of where exactly Jephthah was judging. This is a little bit dark, and I'm sorry for that. But as you can see, on the left here is the Mediterranean Sea. Here's the land of Israel. There's the Dead Sea, and here's the Jordan River and the Sea of Galilee at the top. And we're given a little bit of background, which is, I think, useful of the time period that Jephthah was dealing with. And that's, I think, useful to read. That's in Judges chapter 10. And if we start reading there at verse 6, this is the time period that Jephthah was dealing with. It says there, Judges chapter 10, starting at verse 6, "And the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord, and served Balaam and Ashtaroth, and the gods of Syria, and the gods of Zidon, and the gods of Moab, and the gods of the children of Ammon, and the gods of the Philistines, and forsook the Lord, and served not him. And the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he sold them into the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the children of Ammon. And that year they vexed and oppressed the children of Israel. 18 years, all the children of Israel that were on the other side Jordan in the land of the Amorites, which is in Gilead. Moreover, the children of Ammon passed over Jordan to fight also against Judah and against Benjamin and against the house of Ephraim, so that Israel was sore distressed. And the children of Israel cried unto the Lord, saying, 'We have sinned against thee, both because we have forsaken our God and also served Balaam.'" So you see here that Israel was sold into the hands of the Philistines and the hands of the Ammonites. So they were being squeezed from the east and the west. You can see here that the Philistines are pushing over from the east, and the Ammonites are pushing over from the west. And Jephthah was living and dealing with the people on the other side of the Jordan, so in the land of Gilead, which you see here. That's where Jephthah was from. So he was obviously dealing with the pressure that was coming from the Ammonites, who were pushing in from the east. And just also to notice, over here, just to the north, is the land of Tob, and that's where Jephthah fled to when he was pushed out by his brothers. All right, so that's the geography of and the timeline of where Jephthah fits in to the nation of Israel and the time periods in the Bible. I want to now start off and take a look at Jephthah's life and what we can learn and what we can see from his life. So as we read this evening, we start off reading in Judges chapter 11, verse 1, we read, "Now Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty man of valor, and he was the son of an harlot, and Gilead begat Jephthah. And Gilead's wife bare him sons, and his wife's sons grew up, and they thrust out Jephthah, and said unto him, Thou shalt not inherit in our father's house, for thou art the son of a strange woman. Then Jephthah fled from his brethren, and dwelt in the land of Tob. And there were gathered vain men to Jephthah, and went out with him." There's not all that many words in these three verses, but I think they tell an awful lot about Jephthah's life. We're told that Jephthah was the son of a very influential man, the son of Gilead. He had an influential father, but unfortunately he was born to the wrong mother. His mother was a harlot, a prostitute. It seems that Gilead fully acknowledged that Jephthah was his son, and that Jephthah grew up in the house of Gilead. And he became a mighty man in his father's house. However, Jephthah could never escape from the fact that his mother was not Gilead's wife. His mother was a prostitute. And that stuck with him throughout his life. This is a little fact. It wasn't Jephthah's fault. There was nothing he could do about it. That's just the way it was. And that's what Jephthah was stuck with. It's interesting also, the way it reads, it sounds like Jephthah was Gilead's firstborn son, because it talks about his other sons growing up. And that gives you the impression that Jephthah was older than all these other sons. And there wasn't really a problem until all these other sons grew up and decided that they didn't want Jephthah around. If Jephthah was Gilead's firstborn son, then as the firstborn son, he should have received a double portion of the inheritance. He should have had the inheritance of a firstborn. It seems, however, that when his father died and when that inheritance was being divided up, his other brothers decided that because Jephthah was the son of a prostitute, that he didn't deserve to inherit with them. And so it seems they forced him out. They forced him out of the inheritance he should have received, and he had to flee to the land of Tob. And so Jephthah fled north, and in the area of Tob, he gathered a group of men around him. These men are described in the King James Version as being vain. Other versions are described as empty. If you look up the word, that empty is a reasonably good translation. Other versions describe it as worthless men. These are the men Jephthah found himself surrounded by, empty, worthless, vain men. They were outcasts from society. This is who Jephthah was surrounded by. And they would have been, I think, really hard people to be with, hard people to have to deal with on a day-in and day-out basis. But these were the people Jephthah was stuck with. And they survived by raiding the people around them. They were scavengers who survived by attacking other people and taking their things. That's a pretty tough background. That's a tough way to live. And I think you have to ask yourself, if you were in Jephthah's place, how would this affect you? How would this affect your outlook on life? You know, you've had to deal with the fact that your mother was a prostitute, and you've had to live with that fact as you grew up, that you would be ostracized by the people around you. But you learn to live with that and deal with it. And then suddenly, to have your family kick you out, to force you from your home, force you to flee to the north, away from everything that you knew and was familiar with. That would have been really difficult. And to find yourself surrounded by a group of really rough men, scavenging from the people around you in order to survive. That's a difficult life. If there's anyone who might have been overwhelmed by life's circumstances, I think you can say Jephthah would it be one of those people. If there was anyone who might have been bitter against the God of Israel for what he had received in his life, Jephthah might have been. There didn't seem to be much good that had happened to him. Life for him didn't probably seem to be very fair. But all these events in his life were simply circumstances. They were things that happened to him. There wasn't too much he could do about them. They were circumstances in life. And you see, in all of our lives, we've all been given certain circumstances that we have to deal with. There's a lot of things that we have no control over. Things that we just have to deal with. Some people have more of these circumstances and more challenges than others, and some people have less. That's simply the way it is. That's the hand that we've been dealt. But what we do have control over is how we deal with these circumstances, how they affect us, how they affect our attitude, affect the things that we do, how we respond. And so it's interesting to look at. This is what happened to Jephthah. This was his background. What was his response to that, to this background? How did all these things affect him? Well, it would be really nice to know, but we aren't directly told how Jephthah responded to all these things, how he felt as a result of the events that happened in his life. But there are a few things we can notice. We're told that Jephthah was a mighty man of valor. Around him, he was surrounded by a group of empty, worthless men. But he also became known as a military leader of significant renown, such that when the Gileadites wanted somebody to help them to defend them against the Ammonites, they turned to Jephthah to be their leader, to be their commander. He had obviously developed a reputation as a leader. He had turned this sort of motley group of men into some sort of military group that was a force to be reckoned with. Interesting, he had a lot of qualities of leadership. To be able to work with these men and to change them into some sort of organized force that people had to deal with. It's interesting to think about. If you were in the place of Jephthah, you'd been kicked out by your brothers, you'd gone north, you developed a small little army, and you raided the people around you, you think you might have decided to direct some of those raids against the people of Gilead, to maybe exact some sort of revenge on these people for what they had done to you, to maybe recover some of the things that should have rightly been yours, that they had taken away. It doesn't seem that he did this. It's interesting to read when they come to search for him in Judges chapter 11 and verse 5. It says, "And it was so that when the children of Ammon made war against Israel, the elders of Gilead went to fetch Jephthah out of the land of Tob. And they said unto Jephthah, come and be our captain, that we may fight with the children of Ammon. And Jephthah said unto the elders of Gilead, did not ye hate me and expel me out of my father's house? And why are ye come unto me now when ye are in distress? And the elders of Gilead said unto Jephthah, therefore we turn again to thee now, that thou mayest go with us and fight against the children of Ammon, and be our head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. And Jephthah said unto the elders of Gilead, if ye bring me home again to fight against the children of Ammon, and the Lord deliver them before me, shall I be your head? And the elders of Gilead said unto Jephthah, the Lord be witness between us, if we do not so according to thy words. Then Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and captain over them. And Jephthah uttered all his words before the Lord in Mizpah." If you read those, you get the sense that Jephthah had virtually nothing to do with his brethren. He was to the north and they were to the south. He was cut off from them and he let it be that way. He didn't bother them and they didn't bother him. And so he was a bit surprised when they came up to him and asked him for help. He thought they hated him. He thought they wanted nothing to do with him. I think it's also interesting that when they came asking him for his help, he didn't really try to push them really hard. He simply wanted to know what their intentions were, what they wanted out of the situation. He wasn't trying to exact revenge on them because of what they had done to him. I think it's also really interesting to notice the words he uses when he replies to them. Look at verse 9. He says, "If ye bring me home again to fight against the children of Ammon, and the Lord deliver them before me, shall I be your head?" I think that's an interesting perspective. It wasn't, you know, if I win this battle for you, will I be your leader? It was, if the Lord deliver them into my hands. See, Jephthah had obviously realized that what was important wasn't what he could do. What was important was what God could do working through him. He realized that if he was going to succeed, it wasn't about him, it was all about God. Because it was God who was going to give the victory. It wasn't his skill or his ability. It's also interesting, what guarantee did he have from the men of Gilead that they, after all of this was over, wouldn't just kick him out again like they did the time before? The only guarantee he had was that God would be a witness if they didn't do what they said. And that for Jephthah was enough. Jephthah had obviously realized that what mattered wasn't what the circumstances were. It wasn't the odds that might be stacked against him. What mattered was that what God was going to do in the situation. Whether God was on his side or whether God wasn't on his side. I think that's an interesting perspective from a man who was kicked out of his family, was forced to live as a raider, surrounded by a group of crude and rough men. I think that's a perspective that it doesn't just happen. It's something that you learn and that you develop. It's something that you develop because of an attitude of mind that you make a conscious effort to achieve. It's also interesting to notice that it says in verse 11 that Jephthah uttered all these words before the Lord in Mizpah. If you look up Mizpah, you find out that there's quite a few cities named Mizpah in the land of Israel. But I think this is actually a very special Mizpah. I think it's the first Mizpah we find in the Bible, and that we find in Genesis chapter 31. And there's quite a few similarities between this incident in Genesis 31 and the life of Jephthah. Just to show you that this is likely to be the same Mizpah. Genesis 31 verse 25. And this is the time period when Jacob was trying to leave Laban, and Laban overtakes Jacob. And it says Genesis 31 verse 5. Then Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the mount, and Laban with his brethren pitched in the mount of Gilead. So this is a Mizpah that's on the other side of Jordan in the area of Mount Gilead. So this is likely to be the same Mizpah that we find in the life of Jephthah. Genesis 31 verse 45. It says there, and Jacob took a stone and set it up for a pillar. And Jacob said unto his brethren, gather stones. And they took stones and made a heap. And they'd eat there upon the heap. And Laban called it Jagar Shad Dutha, but Jacob called it Galeed. And Laban said, this heap is a witness between me and thee this day. Therefore was the name of it called Galeed and Mizpah. For he said, the Lord watched between me and thee when we were absent one from another. And if thou shalt afflict my daughters, or if thou shalt take other wives beside my daughters, no man is with us, seeing God is witness betwixt me and thee. And Laban said to Jacob, behold this heap, and behold this pillar, which I have cast betwixt me and thee. This heap be a witness, and this pillar be witness. So I believe this is the same Mizpah that's named in this chapter. And it's interesting to notice the similarities between the life of Jacob here and the life of Jephthah. You see, in both stories, we have men who felt that they had been mistreated. There was injustices that had gone on in their lives. In the life of Jacob, we have a man who was forced to flee from his brother as a result of a conflict over an inheritance. And we find the same thing in the life of Jephthah. In the life of Jacob, he's now returning home. And he comes to Mizpah on his way home. We find the same thing in the life of Jephthah. He was in the land of Tob, and now he's on his way home to the land of Gilead, and he comes through Mizpah. And this Mizpah was to be a memorial that God was a witness between two men. I think that's what Jephthah saw in Mizpah, that once again, God was going to be a witness between him and the Gileadites. And that God would keep his promises if he put his faith and his trust in God, just like God kept his promises with Jacob. All right, so we come back to Judges chapter 11. Jephthah accepted the Gileadites' offer to be their military commander, to take the lead in their battle against the Ammonites. And it's interesting to think about it. If you were given that job, if you were the military commander of the Gileadites, what's the first thing you would do? You have the Ammonites who have their army, and it's marching into your territory. You need to defend yourself against them. What would you do? Well, if I was the military commander, I think the first thing I would do is to figure out how many people I have on my side. What are the odds that I'm dealing with? What kind of army can I raise against these people? That's sort of what a military commander does. You figure out what the odds are, and that affects how you deal with the approaching attacking army. What's Jephthah do? Well, look at verse 12. And Jephthah sent messengers unto the king of the children of Ammon, saying, "What hast thou to do with me, that thou art come against me to fight in my land?" First thing Jephthah does is he sends messengers out. He tries diplomacy rather than starting a war. It's an interesting option for a military commander. That's not usually their first option, but that's what Jephthah does. You find he's a diplomat. You find that if he can avoid a war, he will try to avoid that war. And he gets a response from the children of Ammon, verse 13. And the king of the children of Ammon answered unto the messengers of Jephthah, "Because Israel took away my land when they came up out of Egypt, from Arnon even unto Jabbok and unto Jordan. Now therefore restore those lands again peaceably." So he finds out what the issue is over. And the issue is that Ammon's claiming some of the land of Gilead. Interesting to look at. Here's once again a map of Israel. We have Moab down here, and we have Ammon up here. And if you just highlight this area, Ammon was claiming this region between the rivers of Arnon and Jabbok. So that's this region right here. And they were claiming all of this and saying, "That's our land that you took from us." That's a pretty big chunk of land. That's a rather big problem to deal with if you're living in that area and somebody claims it and says, "This is our land. We want you to give it back." And so Jephthah responds to these messengers, and he recites the history of what happened when Israel came into this land, and explains to the Ammonites that this was never their land. They had never occupied it. This was the land of Sihon, king of the Amorites, and Israel, when they came in, had been very careful to avoid taking any of the land of the Ammonites. It's interesting here that Jephthah has a rather in-depth understanding of the history of Israel. He didn't have to go search out all these little details to find out what exactly happened here. He knew them. I think it tells us that Jephthah spent quite a bit of time studying the history of Israel, studying the law of Moses. He knew what these things were. He knew what the rules were. He knew what had happened, and he could explain this to the people around. But I want you to notice the key point in his argument when he responds to the king of the Ammonites. The key premise of his argument is that God gave Israel this land. And for the Ammonites to lay claim to a land that they had never previously occupied, a land that God had given to Israel, meant that they were challenging the God of Israel. That was his argument. That the Ammonites were not just challenging the Gileadites, they were challenging the God of Israel. And at this point, when he's explained the details, explained to the Ammonites what they're dealing with, what the issues really were, whose side they were on, at this point, Jephthah gathers an army to fight against them. Read that, Judges chapter 11, verse 28. Once the issues were resolved, Jephthah moves quickly. Verse 28, "Howbeit the king of the children of Ammon hearkened not unto the words of Jephthah, which he sent him. Then the spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, and he passed over Gilead and Manasseh, and passed over Mizpah of Gilead, and from Mizpah of Gilead he passed over unto the children of Ammon." He's tried diplomacy, it didn't work. Now he's resorting to war. And he goes through, he collects his army, and he goes to fight against the Ammonites. And at this point, we come to what is probably the most talked about part of Jephthah's life. You see, he made a vow to God. It's a vow that's often referred to as Jephthah's rash vow. But the question is, was it really a rash vow? Was Jephthah the type of person that did things rashly? If you look at everything that Jephthah has done up until this point of time, and even if you look throughout the rest of his life, you'll find that there's nothing that he does rashly. Everything that he does is slow and deliberate. He makes very careful, conscious decisions about the things that he does. When the Gileadites approach him and say, look, we want you to be our leader, he was very careful. He, to find out what exactly they wanted, what the terms were going to be for him to come back. And he understood what their intentions were, and he decided that he was going to come back. When dealing with the Ammonites, he doesn't jump into the war and just organize an army and go and fight them. No, he spends some time working the diplomatic routes, trying to resolve this issue before there's a major conflict, to make sure that everyone understands what's going on, understands why there is a conflict. He doesn't move quickly and he doesn't move rashly. And when dealing with the Ephraimites later on, you find that he's very diplomatic. He's very careful with them. Nowhere do we find him making a rash, foolish decisions. So why would this vow be any different? Why would this be something that he did on the spur of the moment when he did nothing else on the spur of the moment? And I would argue that a rash vow is inconsistent with everything else we find about Jephthah. The second point to notice, and I think this is probably the most important point, is if you look in Hebrews chapter 11, you will find the name of Jephthah. Among the faithful men and women of the Old Testament, you find Jephthah's name listed among the most faithful. There are only four judges that are mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11, and one of those is Jephthah. Of all the faithful men and women, the Old Testament, we're told specifically that Jephthah was one of these faithful people. If this is the case, why would we consider his vow to be a rash, foolish vow? I think Jephthah's vow, because of Hebrews chapter 11, needs to be considered as an example of faith rather than that of foolishness. The reason I think his vow is usually considered to be a rash, foolish vow is because of his response when he finds out what the implication of this vow is. We find that in Judges chapter 11 and verse 34. Jephthah came to Mizpah unto his house, and behold, his daughter came out to meet him with timbrels and with dances, and she was his only child. Beside her he had neither son nor daughter. And it came to pass, when he saw her, that he rent his clothes and said, alas, my daughter, thou hast brought me very low, and thou art one of them that trouble me, for I have opened my mouth unto the Lord, and I cannot go back. She said unto him, my father, if thou hast opened thy mouth unto the Lord, do to me according to that which hath proceeded out of thy mouth, forasmuch as the Lord hath taken vengeance for thee of thine enemies, even of the children of Ammon. His daughter comes out, and he's noticeably upset by the implications of what this vow has meant. But I believe because of Hebrews 11, whatever reason there is for this vow, you have to account for this vow on the basis of faith. But even if you do account for it on faith, even if there is faith involved, it meant this was a hard decision for Jephthah. It meant that he wasn't entirely happy with the outcome, but he was going to deal with that outcome. We'll look at this a little bit later. The other question that usually comes up about this incident is, what happened to Jephthah's daughter? Did Jephthah offer her up as a burnt sacrifice? Well, I think there's four good reasons why you can argue that he didn't offer up for a burnt sacrifice. The first is, would God have been pleased with a human sacrifice? And in the law of Moses, it's very clear that God would not have been pleased with a human sacrifice. Deuteronomy 12 makes it very clear that God views human sacrifice as an abomination. And in Leviticus 20, he talks about a practice of the pagan nations that they had of offering their children to Molech. And he says that this is an abomination and that the people who do this should be stoned to death. So God would not have been pleased if Jephthah had offered his daughter up as a sacrifice. Second reason is, if you actually look at the burnt offerings, you'll find that they are never female and they're never human. So as a burnt offering, this wouldn't fit with how this offering is usually classified. The third point is that if Jephthah's daughter was condemned to die because of her father's vow, wouldn't you think that she would be mourning a little bit more for her life than simply for the loss of her virginity? Like, I understand in those days it was very important for women to have children. But isn't your life a little bit more important than that? Don't you think that she would have mourned the fact that she would no longer be able to live rather than that she would not be able to have children? And the fourth point is that if, and it's the same point we made earlier, if Jephthah is in Hebrews chapter 11, if he's commended for his faith, do you think he would be there if he offered his daughter in a pagan ritual? In a sacrifice that the heathen nations did that God found as an abomination. And I would argue that if he had offered his daughter as a burnt sacrifice, he would not, in fact, be in Hebrews chapter 11. So if he didn't offer as a sacrifice, I think we need to take a closer look at his vow to figure out what exactly he was talking about. What was he actually saying? If you look in Judges chapter 11, verse 31, it says, we'll start at verse 30. And Jephthah vowed a vow unto the Lord and said, if thou shalt without fail deliver the children of Ammon into my hands, then it shall be that whatsoever cometh forth of the doors of my house to meet me, when I return in peace from the children of Ammon, shall surely be the Lord's. And I'll offer it up for a burnt offering. If you look closely at this vow, I think you'll find that the key point here hinges on one really tiny little word. And it's that word, and. And I will offer up it up for a burnt offering. And Bullinger argues that if you look up that word, and, you can equally translate that word as or. So that would read, whatsoever cometh forth of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the children of Ammon shall surely be the Lord's, or I will offer it up for a burnt offering. If that's the case, then that would explain, or it would help us understand this vow. See, what he was saying is that if it's a person that comes out, I will dedicate this person to God. This person will be God's. But if it's an animal, then I will offer that animal up for a burnt offering. Does this make sense with the context of this chapter? Do we have any more evidence for this? If you look, there's actually another piece of evidence that would support this. If you look in verse 40, it says that the daughters of Israel went yearly to lament the daughter of Jephthah, the Gileadite, 4 days in a year. If you look at that word lament, in my margin, it actually has the word to talk with. If you look up that word, you'll find it means to celebrate, to discuss, to commemorate. So it gives you the idea that Jephthah's daughter was not in fact dead, but that she was around, and that there was a custom for the daughters of Israel to go yearly to talk with, to discuss things with Jephthah's daughter. And what I believe fits best here is that Jephthah dedicated his daughter to the Lord, much the way that Samuel was dedicated to God. She was dedicated to the service of God, and as a result of this, she wouldn't have a family, she wouldn't get married. And she would have remained a virgin. And if she was dedicated to God, don't you think it would make sense that the young woman of the land would go to be with her and to talk with her and to learn from her? Because she would have a role as a spiritual leader for them. I think this makes a lot more sense in understanding what might have happened to Jephthah's daughter than that he offered her up as a burnt sacrifice. But we're still left with the question is, what was Jephthah doing, or what was he thinking when he made this vow? If it wasn't a rash vow, what was it then? What was he thinking? And the simple answer is we just aren't told. It doesn't say what Jephthah was thinking. But we can speculate about what he might have been thinking when he offered this vow. And here's one idea. You see, if Jephthah was the firstborn of Gilead, then he should have had a double portion. He should have inherited the role of Gilead, and that is to be a leader of the Gileadites. But he didn't receive this role because he was forced out by his brothers, and he was forced to flee to the land of Tob. I think Jephthah really did want this position. He really did think he would be a good leader for the Gileadites. He was well suited for it. He was a mighty man of valor. When they actually wanted a leader, they went and found Jephthah and brought him back. I think that's his desire for this role is why one of the first things he asked them is, if I am your leader and God delivers these people into my hands, will I be your head? Will you set me up as the leader I should have rightfully been? He wanted to know whether he was going to be given the position he should have had, the position that they forced him out of, the position that he should have had as firstborn. He wanted to be restored to his rightful position. He was very concerned about whether he would in fact be their leader. Consider also that having been restored to the position as head meant that his possessions and his position would then pass on to his children. But he only had one child, and that child was a daughter. How would this happen? I think Jephthah was wondering what exactly God's plan was for him, what God had in store for him. I think he thought about this a lot when he was in the land of Tob. He had obviously been forced to live with the unmistakable fact that God did not want him dealing with the Gileadites and being the leader of Gilead. And that's why he had been forced to flee. And he spent years there wondering what God wanted of him. Did God really not want him to have the job that he thought he was suited for as the leader of the Gileadites? Did God not want him to have the security and stability of an inheritance in Israel? I think he prayed about this. I think he wondered about this. But he'd come to accept the fact that God obviously had other plans for him. And then out of the blue, the Gileadites come up and ask him to be their leader, to be their head, to be what he had always wanted to be. And the other thing Jephthah asked himself, was this really what God had in store for him? Was he to be ruler of the Gileadites or not? Was he to inherit what had been taken away from him? Was his family to have a possession and the stability and security in Israel that would come from this? Is this what God wanted? Was all of this time period in Tob simply a trial period, a waiting period, where God was preparing him for this role? And I think he wasn't sure. He wasn't sure what God had in store for him, what God's plan was. And so he made this vow. And it was a really simple test to see what God's plan was. Was his family to have a continuing position and influence in Gilead? And when his daughter came out, the answer, I think, was clearly and unmistakably no. And this wasn't, I think, the answer that Jephthah wanted. I think he was bitterly disappointed by this response because it meant that God's plan for him was different than what he had hoped it would be. God wasn't going to establish him in the nation. God wasn't going to establish his family. His family was going to die out. His family would never be settled and secure in Israel. God had a role for him to play, but it wasn't exactly the role that he wanted. It was a much smaller part. And he was a bit upset about this, but that was the answer he received. And if you look at the years that all the judges judged for, you'll find that Jephthah judged for the shortest time period of all these judges. And that was the answer Jephthah received from God. But both he and his daughter were willing to accept what God had made known to them. They were willing to cast themselves on the mercy of God and trust that what God's plans were the best plans. And they were going to work with them and try to fit into them to the best of their ability to perform any role that God had in store for them. I think that took a lot of faith, and I think this faith was picked up by the writer in Hebrews chapter 11. It's an interesting lesson for us is that we, when we look at our lives, we might think we have a particular place, a particular role that God wants us to fill. And we have to look and see, is that really the case? Does God want us to perform this role, or is he looking for us to do something else? God may be asking us to do something that isn't exactly what we would have picked to do. God might be directing us someplace to do something that might not be our first choice. I think it's worth looking in our lives and trying to see God's hand at work, trying to see what he's doing and to try to work to the best of our ability with the directions that God gives to us. Well, this is one answer that might explain what Jephthah was thinking when he made this vow. There may be other answers. You may say this is complete speculation, and that's true. It is speculation. But I think it fits reasonably well the facts that we have. And if this is indeed the case, there's another little piece of information here that I think is quite interesting. You see, if Jephthah's daughter was dedicated to God, what do you think that meant for her? Where do you think she went? Well, it meant that she wouldn't be married. It meant that she would spend her life in service to God. It meant that she wouldn't have a family. It meant she wouldn't have children to care for and to raise. And she mourned this because she wanted that. She wanted these things, but she wasn't going to have them. But where did she go? We're not told where she went. But wouldn't it be reasonable that she would go to Shiloh, where the tabernacle was, and to work in service to God in that place of worship? And here's what I think is really interesting, is look at the timing of this. Let's go back to this Bible timeline that we looked at to begin with. Jephthah lived 57 years before the reign of King Saul. We're told in, if you turn with me to 1 Samuel chapter 8, we're told that when Samuel was old, that he made his sons judges over Israel. And the elders of it, skipping down to verse 4, then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came to Samuel and to Ramah and said, behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. We're told that Samuel was old, and the people came to him asking him and saying, we want a king to rule over us like all the nations. And it was this time that Samuel anointed Saul to be king over Israel. Well, how old was Samuel at this time? And we're not told, but I think he was 60 years old. There's a number of things that would you can point to support this. One of these is in Leviticus chapter 27. There's a valuation that's placed upon people depending on how old they are. And from the age of 20 to 60, the highest valuation is placed upon a man, that of 50 shekels. And I think this corresponds to the most important time period of a man's working life. And I think Samuel was reaching the uppermost end of his working life. He was reaching the age of 60. And the people looked and realized that he was going to retire. And they needed a ruler to take his place, to be judge in his place. And they were anxious to have a king that would step into his role, that would lead the nation. When did Samuel, or how old was Samuel when he arrived in Shiloh? Well, we read about his arrival in Shiloh in 1 Samuel chapter 1. We read in 1 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 24, when Hannah brought Samuel to Shiloh, we read there, and when she had weaned him, she took him up with her with three bullocks and one ephah of flour and a bottle of wine and brought him unto the house of the Lord in Shiloh, and the child was young. So the child was weaned and the child was young, but we're not actually given his age. What's interesting, I think the King James isn't a really good translation here. If you read this verse in the ESV, you read this, and when she had weaned him, she took him up with her along with a three-year-old bull. So in place of three bulls, they say that it's actually a three-year-old bull. And I believe here that this bull represented Samuel. This bull was a three-year-old bull because Samuel was 3 years old when he was brought to Shiloh. If Samuel was 60 when Saul became king, and he was 3 when his mother brought him to Shiloh, then he arrived 57 years before Saul was crowned king. And that is exactly the same time that Jephthah was a judge, and when Jephthah's daughter was dedicated to the service of God. You see, Jephthah's daughter would not have her own children, but I believe God put her in the right place at the right time to be a mother to a little boy who'd been dedicated to the service of God at a very young age, and who would have been in desperate need of a mom during this time period as he grew up, and a mother figure as he began his service to God in Shiloh. And this little boy, Samuel, one day would grow up to be one of the greatest prophets and judges that the nation would ever have. He would anoint David, the greatest king that Israel would ever know, until Jesus returns to set up his kingdom on his throne. And I think it's interesting. God had a plan for Jephthah, and he had a plan for Jephthah's daughter, and they didn't know what it was. But they were willing to work with his plans, to work with them to the best of their abilities, and to become a part of his great plan of salvation that he had for this earth.